Happy International Women's Day, Boston, and welcome to BNN News. I'm Natalie Candler. Thanks for tuning in. The race for the 2024 presidency has officially begun, and on Super Tuesday, residents made the first choice on who they will support.
This week is Super Tuesday, when the greatest number of states hold primary elections and caucuses before November's Election Day. Although political pundits are in a stir over results, quiet polling locations in Boston tell a different story. With no long lines of voters and a lack of campaign posters outside venues, the dynamic of voting is changing. BNN caught up with residents casting their vote on what they expect from the next commander-in-chief.
I'd like to see real leadership on issues that affect our country, and we need that. So I'm hoping that we'll have a change this electoral season, and we will have true leadership.
I voted for democracy. I voted for decency. I voted for economic prosperity. I voted for national security. I voted for a future and not being dragged down and dragged back.
Some voters emphasize their need for a president who focuses on the issues most pressing to them.
I think we need to improve the value of the dollar so that a McDonald's hamburger doesn't cost a working family 15 bucks. We need to secure the border so we can reduce the crime rate and the fentanyl influx. We need to have more world peace and less instability around the world. And we need a stronger national defense.
I'm here casting my vote because I believe voting is one way of letting my elected officials know what's important to me. Important to me about climate change, about equality not only in our way of life, but equality in jobs, equality in health care, especially to vote veterans and getting veterans' needs fulfilled.
The long-anticipated presidential vote has steadily divided public opinion for nearly 10 years, and with the presumed candidates, President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump, leading in their respective parties, some voters feel the country is more disconnected than ever.
We're not talking to each other enough. People are feeling very divided, and some of the rhetoric is further dividing people, and we need people that are willing, in leadership positions, that are willing to stop that rhetoric and bring people back together.
At the John D. O'Brien African American Institute at Northeastern University, the newly formed Office of Black Male Advancement brought together black men and boys. The mission? To see them thrive.
I cannot do everything.
But I can do something.
But I can do something.
And what I can do,
and what I can do,
I ought to do.
I ought to do.
And what I ought to do,
what I ought to do,
I will do.
I will do.
Powerful words of affirmation opened the Empowerment Summit, hosted by the Office of Black Male Advancement, OBMA. Friday's gathering marked the first summit for the office, created in February 2022. OBMA Executive Director and Roxbury native Frank Farrell wants to eliminate the obstacles that have held black men back in the city.
There are a lot of, you know, socioeconomic, you know, barriers that, you know, black men and boys face. Even, you know, just trying to get to a level playing field, you know, on a day-to-day in their lives, you know, generational inequities. And that's why we're focusing on, through the Office of Black Male Advancement, changing the narrative and ensuring that we're creating pathways and opportunities for generational pathways to success and opportunity.
The Day of Conversation, renewing Boston's commitment to black men and boys, stressed entrepreneurship and home ownership as means to improvement. Yet leaders are keenly aware of what black men face on a daily basis.
So when we're talking about black students and our black children, they are oftentimes more than their white counterparts born into disadvantageous situations, whether it is poverty, whether they're victims of classism, racism, the conditions that we set for our kids to thrive, especially black children, are miles behind their white counterparts because of the lack of generational wealth, the lack of property, the laws and policies that are designed historically to keep black children from reading, from having access to education, access to bank accounts, access to land. And now we are seeing the fallout And all of a sudden, people are acting like it's new when it's historically been this way for a very long time.
Data from the 2023 State of Black Males in Boston report show the stakes are high. Black men are the only racial group to experience homicide as a top five cause of death, have the lowest rate of high school graduation, and over 60% make less than $50,000 a year. Leaders agree that engaging black boys in their formative school years is key.
One of the things we learn is our boys don't understand careers. And so part of what we need is, what is the career that you want to be, right? Because if you can't see it, you can't be it. And so part of what we have to do, all of us in every city, is to show career early. Show the translatable skills early. Show why you want to focus on an aspirational goal and career, because school is the pathway to career pathway. And if we don't have our boys in school, we don't have our boys in a career pathway.
What I'll say very quickly is Dr. Jawanza Kanjufu published a book in the early 80s that talked about the destruction of little black boys. And that begins as early as third grade. So there's seminal research that focuses on that. And if we don't understand the emphasis that we need to put on these young black boys as early as third grade, it already puts them in a trajectory that denies them the same opportunities as others within society.
The Office of Black Male Advancement believes equitable access to opportunity for black men transforms not only their lives, but Boston's black community. It's a dream OBMA is making a reality, one black boy at a time.
On Wednesday, Governor Maura Healey announced a new proposal to dedicate $20 million to ending veteran homelessness.
They're the heroes of our nation who fight fearlessly in the name of American defense and freedom. Yet when they return home, far too many veterans find themselves in vulnerable positions, facing a significant risk of experiencing homelessness.
No veteran should ever be homeless, period. Since 2023, approximately 1,500 veterans have interacted with our homeless providers across Massachusetts. It is now our chance to serve the people who have served our nation. And I'm convinced that working with the Executive Office of Veterans Affairs, we can provide education and outreach to strengthen our connections with veterans who are experiencing homelessness. We can find permanent housing solutions to our veterans, and we can work with our community-based providers to ensure supportive housing and wraparound services. We can and we will accomplish these goals together.
The Healey-Driscoll administration announced a $20 million campaign on Tuesday to end veteran homelessness in Massachusetts. This groundbreaking housing initiative will include the largest targeted investment to address veteran homelessness in state history.
Currently in Massachusetts, it's estimated that between 500 to 600 veterans are homeless on any given night, with hundreds more facing housing insecurity. Our goal is to reach out to every single one of them with the offer of permanent, quality, affordable housing that they deserve and that they need. Our goal is to be there for them just as they were there for us.
They come back caring a lot. And it's so important then that when we say, "Welcome home, soldier," they actually have a home to go to. That is what this is about. That is this moment. It isn't just talk. I've worked with every single one of these individuals. Our hearts and are in line, and the mission is clear. We are going to house veterans. We are going to end homeless veterans in the state of Massachusetts.
Across all political parties, taking care of veterans post-service is something everyone can agree on, especially in light of veteran homelessness rates nationwide. According to the National Coalition for Homeless Veterans, 13% of homeless adult populations are veterans.
When a young person, a young American, raises their right hand and swears to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, it's a blank check. It can mean they're giving their all. And as a nation and as a community, we have an obligation, and we have made that an obligation, to be able to support veterans after their military service, regardless of what challenges they may face.
My son Nicholas was killed in combat at age 21. He rests in the National Cemetery, frozen in time, at age 21. But we need to make sure we take care of his brothers and sisters in combat forever. Massachusetts leads the way. We need to make sure all our veterans are taken care of from all wars.
The administration seeks to bring veteran homelessness rates to, quote, functional zero. That means creating a system where homelessness is rare, brief, and non-recurring, where every veteran has a safe place to rest his head each night.
With 6 months left in their teaching contracts, the Boston Teachers Union has listed demands that advocate for over 8,000 educators on their first day of contract negotiations.
On Thursday, Boston Teachers Union, BTU, and supporters named their priorities for a new contract with Boston Public Schools. High on their list is increased pay for educators, particularly paraprofessionals, who BTU considers the backbone of schools.
Paras in the city of Boston make less than $50,000 annually. And in fact, some of them make as little as $32,800 annually, or just over $20 per hour. That's wrong. If you think about what was shared about the median cost of housing, $3,000, first month, last month, plus security, that's $9,000 to move into an apartment. And when the educators of Boston can't afford to move into a home in Boston, that's something we have to fix.
We as paraprofessionals should be able to live and work in the city that we have grown up in and dedicated our personal lives to. How can we create a sense of community around our school if we can't even afford to live in this community? Sorry. It doesn't make sense that we work for BPS and we cannot afford our own home. I am one of those people that cannot afford this.
Students expressed the need for high-quality programs and improved facilities within their schools, as BPS proposes closing dozens of classrooms to balance next year's school budget.
Properly funded and supported facilities for extracurriculars allow students to apply what their teachers taught them in the classroom to real-world activities that they enjoy and can see themselves doing in the future. They allow students and educators to collaborate and reinforce a sense of community that cannot be established in just the classroom. We have talents, character, and dreams ready to pursue that deserve to be nurtured. This is not a luxury, but a necessity.
Parents join BTU in calling for more ESL and special needs teachers. BPS figures show that nearly one in every two students speaks a language other than English at home, and one in five students has a disability.
I'm here because we need a lot of resources in our school, the Blackstone. We need more psychologists, social workers, paraprofessionals, specialists, reading specialists, and bilingual teachers, because we have a lot of children whose language is Spanish and they don't understand the instructions. So we lack a lot of resources and a lot of support in our school that we need for our children to succeed.
We're continuing to fight for special education inclusion done right. This means having enough educators and specialized staff to meet the individualized and special needs of all students, including multilingual and English as second language students. We're focused on raising standards for our students. We're fighting for the nationally recommended ratios of students to school counselors, students to school psychologists, and additional social workers, standards we still lag in.
The contract for Boston Teachers Union ends in 6 months. BTU members are determined to meet the needs of students and the 8,000-plus educators who teach in Boston public schools. Properly educating the next generation of city residents is essential to Boston's vitality.
MBTA buses have been busy these past 3 weeks due to the Green Line shutdown, but recent pedestrian crashes leave some nervous. Reporter Sophia Falbo spoke to residents about their concerns.
CBS News says three pedestrian crashes with an MBTA bus occurred since 2024. The most recent accident on February 20th left a man with life-threatening injuries.
We live in a very densely populated area.
We have lots of conflicts in terms of how intersections are laid out. So it really is an issue that the T needs to work with municipalities as well as safety organizations.
Sarah Bajaj says the recent bus incidents make her feel unsafe walking and riding the bus.
That makes me feel so unsafe. I don't want to be walking near a bus and have the chance of me getting hit. And even being in the bus, I feel like that's also traumatizing for the people who are riding it. The driver should definitely be way more careful.
An MBTA spokesperson says their focus is on rider well-being and that they conduct investigations after accidents. Terrence Regan says he takes the bus daily and safety should be the MBTA's highest priority. He offered advice for nervous pedestrians.
If, as a pedestrian, you are worried, pay attention. Don't wear your headphones so you can't hear oncoming traffic, and be alert.
The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says 42 pedestrian bus crashes happened in 2021. Reporting for BNN, this is Sophia Falvo.
With empty office rates and housing prices at an all-time high, the downtown area of Boston has become scarcely populated, which is why the Boston Globe has been working on a new project that outlines a plan to revitalize the downtown Boston area. We asked ideas writer and editorial board member David Scharfenberg to the studio to discuss how we can bring downtowns back and why a centralized area in the city is so important to residents. Enjoy the conversation between David and Faith.
David, thank you for joining us here in the studio.
Sure thing. Happy to be here.
Fabulous. Well, I want to jump right into the new series that has come out with the Boston Globe, the Blueprints for Downtown piece. Can you tell us more about the series and what was the inspiration behind it?
Sure. Well, our Boston Globe offices are right downtown, so we had kind of a front row seat to what was happening there and saw what I think a lot of people understand, which is that the place is a little emptier than it used to be. With the pandemic came along, and people are going to the office maybe 3 days a week or so, and the place is kind of in need of reinvention of some kind. So we decided to take this on with a bunch of pieces. We got 7 or 8 stories, kind of with different ideas about what might be done to revitalize the neighborhood and take it in interesting new directions.
Excellent. I definitely love the proactiveness about the piece. Yeah. Can you talk about some of the highlights of the series in terms of some of the solutions offered?
Sure. So we had all kinds of interesting ideas. We had a writer who worked for the Globe for a short time and recently wrote a book about American manufacturing and what can be done to kind of revitalize it. And she suggested, well, why don't we take some of these empty office spaces downtown and turn them into high-tech manufacturing? Not the kind of dirty old manufacturing we think of from 100 years ago, but something a little quieter, a little more high-tech that could fit in with downtown.
Right.
And use these kind of big open office floors, dedicate them to this sort of work, and that could provide jobs for young people in Boston and create kind of that kind of density where people can share ideas and innovate. So that was one idea. We had another person who actually lives downtown write about how to make downtown more family friendly for kids and talked about, maybe there's room for Spanish lessons or an indoor play space, something along those lines. And then we talked about kind of borrowing ideas from other cities that have tried to use more public art to draw folks downtown. Even some open carry laws, maybe have some sort of festival downtown, let people walk around with an adult beverage or two.
I'm about it.
that gives you a flavor for it.
Excellent. Definitely want to partake in some of these block parties in the downtown portion. And what does the future of downtown look personally to you?
Well, my contribution to the series was saying, downtown isn't as bad off as people tend to think it is. There's some interesting research that a nonprofit out of Philadelphia did where they took some cell phone location data where you can kind of track, foot traffic. Are people returning to downtown or not? Yeah. And they found that it's better than we think. Nationwide, they looked at 26 cities, including Boston, and said, about 80% of the foot traffic that there was pre-pandemic. They defined downtown more broadly than we did for this package. For Boston, for instance, they included, the Back Bay and the North End, some of the places that are a little busier than the heart of downtown. But anyway, I think there's something to build on there. People want to be back in these places. And then it's just a matter of being creative. And there's some, you know, some folks who are thinking creatively about it. There is some new public art downtown. Maybe you've seen these giant clown heads, you know, wedged between a couple of buildings. The downtown Boston Business Improvement District, which is funded by local businesses, has had some of these block parties, you know. Mm-hmm. They had one directed to black professionals, another one that was a Cinco de Mayo event that they did in, with the Mexican consulate, which is based downtown. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they tried to bring some more small businesses from the neighborhoods into downtown. So there's some interesting thinking going on. There's still a long way to go. The place is not doing as well as the Back Bay or the North End. Mm. But it's a chance to reinvent what was kind of a stodgy neighborhood. So I think that's a plus.
And why is it important to revitalize downtown Boston?
I think, you know, it's the commercial core of the city. I mean, this is, it's very important economically. I mean, these big office towers are a very important source of tax revenue for the city. And when they're half empty, they're not as valuable, and that means the owners aren't paying, you know, property taxes as large as they once were. That can lead to cuts in city services, et cetera. But it's also just about kind of the soul of the place. You know, people want to have a common kind of gathering space where they can see people from all different parts of the city, where they can meet a friend for a drink or lunch, that kind of thing. And so I think, just in terms of the cultural feel of the city and the economic vitality of the city, it is important to figure out what we're going to do with this place. Mm,
definitely, restoring that energy.
Yeah.
And when we talk about downtown, reimagining the space, we're talking about urban planning, essentially.
Yes.
How does urban planning affect the daily lives of our residents?
I think it's very important. I mean, on the neighborhood level, I mean, you see what the mayor is proposing, for instance, along Blue Hill Avenue, kind of completely remaking the place, you know, more trees and bike lanes, et cetera. So that affects people's day-to-day lives in the neighborhoods. You know, housing and zoning matters a lot, what kind of housing can be built, and expanding the housing supply, which is really important in the midst of this housing crisis we're having. So that's super important. And then when you think about places like the downtown, you really need smart, creative use of planning and public funds to maybe subsidize for a bit. You know, if you want a daycare downtown to attract families, like, it's probably not going to do great at the outset because you don't have a lot of families there now.
Yes.
So maybe there's a way to provide some financing, and then maybe that draws more families and makes it sustaining. So those bets that the public sector place on what they think is important, I think, you know, can nudge things in one direction or another.
Wonderful. Yeah. And the Blueprint series, it's 9 parts. There's a section that includes input from readers about their own ideas, which I think is excellent.
Yeah.
How can viewers learn more and read the series?
So if you go to our website, bostonglobe.com, the ideas section is housed within the opinion section of the paper. So if you click on opinion up there, you'll find your way to the ideas section. And we've still got several of the pieces up there. And as you say, some reader ideas as well. So that's kind of fun to check out. And our designers did some pretty cool kind of charts and graphs about what's happening, and just some kind of moving animations of downtown buildings that are fun to check out.
Thank you for tuning in, Boston. As a reminder, you can stream or watch the news on demand on our new and improved website, bnnmedia.org. Each episode will be rebroadcast at 9:30 p.m. and 11 p.m. on Xfinity Channel 9, Sound Channel 15, and Fios Channel 2161. And make sure to check out our BNN HD Xfinity Channel 1072. You can also listen to us on the radio on Fridays at 7:30 and 9 p.m. and Monday through Thursday at 9 p.m. And don't forget, you can always watch BNN News on the go with the Cablecast app. For BNN News, I'm Natalie Candler. Have a great night.